As Australians look on with a feeling of helplessness and horror at the escalating conflict in Iraq, the threat of all-out war between Ukraine and Russia, and the seemingly never-ending conflict between Israel and Palestine, many are wondering if war is inevitable or if there's another way. Former Irish President Mary McAleese grew up in Belfast, caught between warring Protestants and Catholics, amid the violent tactics of the IRA and the retaliation of British-backed loyalists. She went on to oversee a peace process that brought a divided country together and followed the wise words of Nelson Mandela to make partners of former enemies. Mary McAleese is presenting the Nelson Mandela Lecture in Adelaide this evening, but made time to speak to me earlier today.
It seemed to me that Nelson Mandela's words offered a way of navigating out of what seemed to be a constant zero-sum game that we never managed to get out of. All sorts of efforts had been made as I was growing up to resolve the conflict, but all of them seemed to end in failure. And it did seem to me that Nelson Mandela's words offered a spirit of generosity, rather than sitting down to, if you like, hard, cold political negotiations where people on both sides were so deeply mutually suspicious of each other that very often those meetings led to instant breakdown, that he offered the prospect of building a shared platform of people who were always going to be neighbours to one another and would be better off if they could find a way of becoming good neighbours who worked in partnership.
But people have to be ready to receive a message like that, don't they?
There is certainly a long period of persuasion. We were very fortunate that not only had we icons like Mandela making these statements, but we had someone at home like John Hume, who was Nobel Peace Laureate and the great champion of dialogue and discussion. Over and against that, of course, we had a long culture of paramilitarism that didn't want to hear about discussion, dialogue and the use of politics. You've had the constitutional politician who argues for debate and believes that we can discuss things through to conclusion, and those who say, no, the only thing that empires understand, if you like, is violence. Those two traditions, thankfully, in this generation, have now been reconciled. It happened in a very simple way that people who had been sent to prison, who were paramilitaries, they began to get tired. And when they got tired, people who were dealing with them, who were actually going to the prison and talking to them, intuited that tiredness. I'm thinking of people like the priest Father Alec Reed, who was the real seed corn of the peace process. He intuited that the paramilitaries of a particular generation were tired. They had figured out that they couldn't win the war and they couldn't lose it. They'd figured out that the British government and the British military establishment, with all its military might, also couldn't win the war and couldn't lose it. So they were kind of in stalemate. And it was a time for fresh thinking. And it was at that moment that he was able to persuade people like John Hume, to persuade Gerry Adams, to persuade the IRA, that there had to be an alternative strategy that would work for them, that would not involve violence.
There also has to be a vision of what peace might look like and how change might happen, doesn't there?
Conflict is easy. Anger is easy. Believe me, it's the easy thing. The gravitational pull of anger is so strong that we're constantly fighting against our better nature, if you like. So the angry thing, the violence thing was easy to get into. It is so, so hard to get out of, because building peace requires, as you say, vision. It requires people to step outside of their own constituency and be big enough to say that they want to engage with the otherness of others, that they don't any longer want to hold them in contempt, they want to make friends with them. It also means on both sides eventually having to acknowledge that you made mistakes and that perhaps your behaviour was appalling.
Anger, though, comes from a sense of having been wronged. And how do you then overcome that natural human desire to have that wrong answered in some way with an act that you feel justifies the level, if you like, of that wrongness or that wrongdoing?
Part of the problem, you quite rightly say, there is a long catalogue of history of wrongs, and you can live your life completely bound by those and wanting forever to vindicate them. Regrettably, in a conflict situation, there comes a point where you have to acknowledge that if you want to create a future free of those wrongs, you also have to free yourself from the shackles of wanting vengeance. That wanting vengeance for those wrongs simply perpetuates a situation where conflict it comes inevitable. But if you want a wrong-free zone in the future, the people who inflicted those wrongs upon you, who live next door to you, they have to be the partners that you're going to create this new world with. You may have to forgive. You may have to forget. Or you may have to agree neither to forgive nor to forget, but to get on in the present, to actually find in the present some way of working together. And sooner or later, somebody had to start telling the truth the right way up, but also to be able to move beyond that. Not to say that people have not to take responsibility, you know, where there have been criminal actions and where people have committed terrible wrongs, there had to be process, there had to be culpability, there had to be courts, there had to be convictions. But sooner or later, we had to take a chance on each other. And so what we have in Northern Ireland today is a government that is formed by people who were historically determined that over their dead bodies would they ever talk to each other. Well, today they're in government, working together. Why? Because you have to put the past behind you in order not to be crippled by it in the future.
How frustrating is it for you when you see world leaders making statements that are exclusive in nature? And I'm thinking here about statements like you're either with us or against us, that kind of approach that we've seen in recent years. We've had our own Prime Minister Tony Abbott say that we only want people here in Australia who are part of Team Australia.
I don't want to comment on local politics here. I think it would be impertinent to do that. But I will say this, that exclusivity creates enmity. It leaves people out. When you leave people out, it means that there is no dialogue between you and them. It allows people to sink even further into a sense of injustice. It allows rage and fury, regrettably, to grow. We've seen it, for example, with Islam. Islam is not of its nature a conflict-ridden or a hate-filled religion, any more than is Christianity, any more than is Judaism. All of them, regrettably, have had historically their fundamentalists, their people who have used conflict. And I think it's important that all of us acknowledge that we come from backgrounds where not everything that was done in our name or by our ancestors is something that we want to stand over. And that the world that we want to create is not a world of enemies, but a world of friends. And the only way we do that is, as Nelson Mandela says, to make a partner of your enemy. Don't fill your enemy with the fuel of resentment by giving him the space, if you like, to indulge in victimhood.
Former Irish President Mary McAleese, who's delivering the Nelson Mandela Lecture in Adelaide tonight.